man. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, here with News Dissector Radio. Every time, every week at this time on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, Polar Levine, a.k.a. in the musical world, Polarity One, is sitting here with me. We're going to be talking about two different but maybe not so different issues that deal with injustice. One is the issue of the former governor, believe, of Arkansas, Don Siegelman, who is in prison, and his daughter is going to be joining us to help us explain this case and what people are trying to do about it. Then in the second half of the program, we're going to talk with Frank Emspach. Frank, I first met, was a shop steward, union activist in Massachusetts, in Lynn, Mass. He worked for General Electric. He worked in a number of places. He was a union militant for many years. He lives in Wisconsin now, and he's running, or one of the people running, the Workers Independent News. So we're going to talk about the state of the union. So all of that is coming up here on News Dissector Radio. But first, we like to start with a little appropriate song, and this is one from Polarity One, and appropriate to the weather as well, Winter in America.
Just an American lad and his lassie, 20 years popping rivets in a chassis. American dream died in his sleep. Kids gone hungry when you get the pink sheet. Your luck is down, the plan is closed. We get laid off, Bob gets paid off. What you gonna do when you get home? Winter in America chills to the bone. Winter in America chills to the bone. You walk the streets all day, 3 months, no job, no pay. You gotta believe the system works for you, but it's a power lunch, and you're the beef stew. Your wife's out looking for a slave, 4 kids sitting home alone. What's 20 years in the union for? Congratulations, you're one of the four. Winter in America chills the bone. Winter in America chills the bone. Winter in America chills the bone. Winter in America chills the bone.
Before we start, tell us a little bit about that song. It's really riveting and gripping, and yet it's also very relevant and timely. You wrote it a few years back.
Yeah, I wrote it a few years back. It's actually a rewrite of an old Bob Dylan song called Hollis Brown. None of his lyrics are the same, but it's based on the idea. He had it on a farm. I used a guy in an auto plant, and he was watching his children starve. He's watching his wife starve. And then finally, boom, he kills them all.
Well, that's unfortunately very appropriate. Also, we're in the guns of January are about to give way to the guns of February. We've just had a number of new shooting incidents, and the whole battle about gun control and what it, if anything, it can do is raging in Washington. The NRA has taken a stand that says no gun reform, period, and others are fighting for changes in the law and demands for verification and people having had to go through some sort of background, leaving some background information when they buy a weapon. So that issue is in the mainstream media. One issue that's not in the mainstream media, at least not enough, is a case that's bizarre involving a former Democratic governor, very popular one, who was basically challenging political system on a whole bunch of issues and now finds himself behind bars. It's a case that people who follow Democratic Party politics carefully know about, but not everyone does. Joining us on the line, Dana Siegelman. Dana, are you with us?
I am.
Yeah, let me just say apologies to you. You agreed to come on. You were agreed someone agreed for you to come on a show without talking to you. And so we went ahead. Our vast publicity machine went into top gear promoting your being on the program. And then you had something else to do. But I'm so happy that you agreed to join us. I'm sorry for any poor communications. You'll find, Dana, the more you do this, that the worst communications takes place inside the communications business, okay? Where people are supposed to know what they're talking about and supposed to know how to do things, and they mostly screw up or screw up a lot. So I'm glad that you're here with us. Tell us a little bit about the situation involving your dad and how this whole case developed, because, you know, it seems like something out of an Orwell story, you know, bizarre movie.
It really does. It is bizarre. I feel like I'm in like a bit of a thriller. But basically, my dad was the longest running Democrat in the Southeast. He was the first governor to come out and endorse Al Gore for president against Bush. And at the time, he was, you know, one of the most popular politicians in the state. He'd been the only person, Republican or Democrat, to hold all of the highest elected offices in Alabama.
I said Arkansas by mistake. Sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, no, that's okay. That's fine. Yeah. Well,
that's why you want to know why. You probably want to know why. Because I went to a luncheon that Bill Clinton addressed today. So I got a little Arkansas on my brain. Okay. Let's pick up the story.
Well, he was the only person to be Secretary of State, Attorney General, Lieutenant Governor, Governor. And so he was very much looking to run on a national scale. He had been touted by a conservative journal as possibly a dark horse candidate for the 2004 election. So after Gore had, you know, quote unquote, lost to Bush. But unfortunately for my dad, he was indicted in 2002. For bribery. What happened in that case is it was thrown out the very first day in court, but it was enough to basically shake up his plan. So he promised to run again in 4 years, and then 1 month before his reelection campaign in 2005, he was actually indicted again by the Bush administration for bribery. What's so amazing about this case is the U.S. prosecutor appointed by Bush was married to the man running my father's opponent's campaign. So the campaign manager's wife actually indicted my father. What's more egregious is that the judge that presided over the case, that was allowed to preside over the case, actually had run campaigns against my father for years in Alabama. He had sat on the GOP executive committee. He was appointed by George W. Bush as well. And 3 days after convicting my father, was given a $200 million defense contract with the Bush administration. So his actual job, or his, I should say, primary job, was not being a federal judge, but was actually running a company out of Colorado that provided soldiers uniforms in Iraq and Afghanistan, refueled planes, trained pilots. And a lot of the characters in this case, you know, it does sort of appear like a thriller. You think, wow, this is just way too obvious. But you know what? They got away with it because my dad's in prison right now, and that's why I'm out here speaking and asking people for help. I've started a petition at free-don.org. You can just Google Free Don. You can learn lots more about
Free Don. Say it again. Say it again, because you have a certain twang that maybe people in New York, here in the city, if you get my drift, might not recognize. So say it again, the URL.
It is free-don.org.
Don is your father's first name, right? Let's establish that for the record, okay?
Yes.
Okay.
My dad is Don Siegelman, former Democrat of Alabama, and the website is free-don.org. And so please go there and learn, you know, as much as you want. There are videos and clips, but definitely sign the petition and add your voice to this movement.
Now, let me ask you one question. Does the phrase conflicts of interest mean anything in Alabama? I mean, it seems pretty riddled with conflicts of interest. People aligned with his political opponents, in essence, judging him and helping to bring legal charges against him.
Well, it's kind of phenomenal because, you know, most of Alabama is red. And so a lot of the people by chance were Republicans anyway. And then, of course, those that were appointed by George W. Bush, who were intimately involved in this scheme, you know, had their own agenda. But, you know, unfortunately, we had two whistleblowers come forward after the case was closed. So their evidence, I mean, basically their affidavits and their sworn testimonies to Congress haven't actually helped Dad get a new trial. So it's interesting because we all know now that Karl Rove helped pull strings at the Department of Justice and was sort of directing and encouraging these political prosecutions, specifically in Alabama, but we know of other cases across the country where this happened. And, you know, what's unfortunate is that, you know, these Republican operatives who were involved really didn't understand the depths of deception or misconduct that their, you know, bosses were involved in. And so, you know, it was really up to them and their own conscience to come forward later. And it's, yeah, so I don't want to point fingers at every single Republican in Alabama, because certainly a lot of them are upset and understand that, you know, an injustice occurred and then wish they had done something earlier. But, you know, for the six people that were intimately involved, of course, you know, they were strategic GOP operatives appointed by Bush, and they are still, I mean, you know, in power, have jobs in Alabama. The governor and his son have done very well. He, you know, the man who ran against my father did win that election and went on. And so, you know, no one's really, there's been no consequences for this travesty. And, you know, my dad didn't commit a crime, which is interesting because, you know, you can target someone and then find they're actually guilty of something. That's a different story, because then you're like, well, there was a valid conviction even though he was targeted. In my dad's case, he was wrongly targeted and wrongly convicted. So he was convicted of something that's never been a crime in this country, which is an implied quid pro quo. That means an inferred bribe or a bribe without explicit proof of an agreement. There was no self-enrichment scheme. Neither party was.
So in other words, it's like Polar. If you come on my show next week, I think I might be able to get you on, you know, a major television program to appear on that program, possibly.
Ooh, and I'll be a star.
Exactly. But I mean, it seems like, you know, the law can be used in such a sanctimonious way without any proof. If you have the word bribery associated with you, you are assumed guilty, not innocent.
Well,
of some, let's put it that way.
Yeah, so it's so incredible, but the jury really did not want to convict my father. They deliberated for 9 days, which is an extraordinarily long amount of time, and the judge basically threatened them and said, I can keep you here until next July. You know, that's no problem. I'm appointed for life. And the very next day, they came up with a conviction on this inferred bribery charge. What's interesting is that the judge lowered the standard of law to get that. You know, usually in a bribery charge, you'd have to have explicit proof. The witness in my father's case had contradictory testimony. He was plea bargaining for his life because he had been formally convicted to 10 years, and he was given 18 months for cooperating with the prosecution against my father, which happens all the time. And that's what's so scary is about, you know, we look at this case and there's just, you know, level after level after level of misconduct, and it's clear because you could see how these people knew each other, how they were involved, what their agenda was, how they were benefiting financially.
Didn't Alberto Gonzalez become a TV star connected with this, with stacking the Justice Department full of cronies?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of scandals involving the Justice Department, but this case seems to rise above many others, because here's a former very popular politician and governor in prison as a result of direct political shenanigans. I know an NYU professor here in New York, Mark Crispin Miller. I don't know if you know him or not. Dana,
yes.
was
yes.
a real advocate on your father's behalf and tried to raise this question. But a lot of people sort of backed away because they felt, well, you know, there's corrupt politicians everywhere, and why, and you know, if they're, you know, if there's smoke, there's fire, he's probably guilty of something kind of thing. Or they didn't want to get too involved. It seems like a lot of Democrats abandoned him as well.
Actually, quite the opposite.
Okay, I stand corrected.
Yeah, there are several members of Congress who, you know, strongly believe what happened to my dad is totally egregious, goes against our Constitution. You know, you might have seen some of them, Linda Sanchez, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Robert Wexler, John Kerry. I mean, a number of people have come forward and said what happened to Don Siegelman is wrong, and this is not how our country functions. We do not target people in this country. We do not lower the standard of law to get a conviction on some, you know, especially in the light of Citizens United and the funneling of millions of dollars where we don't even know what the agenda is. And yet, you know, when my father's motive was raising money for an education lottery for underprivileged kids to go to college for free, you know, he's convicted of bribery.
Are those are those Democrats doing anything about it now other than feeling sympathetic?
There are a handful of Democrats, and I should say Republican congressmen too, who are interested in seeing that this gets corrected. I don't know that they have a strategy. I don't know what, you know, what how they feel they can best help. But I do know that my dad has an enormous amount of support. In fact, I would say he's probably the luckiest human being in an American prison today, simply for the fact that people know what happened to him. And I can't think of anyone, Republican or Democrat, who actually thinks my father should be in prison except for the prosecutors, the judge, the, you know, former governor of Alabama. I mean, those people that were intimately involved in seeing that he was taken out of politics and convicted of this, you know, ridiculous non-crime are the only people I can think of that actually still think he should be there.
So it's a little bit like a political assassination. I mean, not a physical assassination, but a political elimination of somebody who symbolically can represent, you know, for them all of the crimes that they associate with Democrats.
Well, on the, one of the whistleblowers that came forward, you know, speaking of a phone call between the U.S. prosecutor and her husband, Bill Canary, and the Rileys, who were running against my father. And basically, Rob Riley, the son of the governor, said, you know, this judge is going to hang Don Siegelman. Basically, you know, a public lynching, as you're saying, you know, political assassination, but certainly that's what they wanted. They wanted him to go to prison. That was their goal. So, I mean, it's clear just because of the, you know, what we know, that this wasn't just, you know, let's indict him and hope that that's enough to ruin his reputation. They had tried that once before, and he was running again, so they thought, in fact, another quote from these people is that my dad was a cockroach that wouldn't die. I mean, so basically saying, you know, he's not going to stop unless we do something to stop him.
Well, didn't he get a lot of visibility and publicity? Wasn't he on 60 Minutes or other programs talking about his case?
Yes, so 60 Minutes followed up after he was dragged away in handcuffs and shackles in 2007. I think that's what raised a lot of eyebrows, is that this judge, instead of giving my dad the 45 to 90 days to put his affairs in order, say goodbye to his family, you know, forward any medical prescriptions to prison that he might need, he was dragged away that day in handcuffs and leg manacles, put in a maximum security prison in Atlanta in solitary confinement, and then moved around the country. Yes, and then moved around the country for 2 months until he landed at Oakdale, Louisiana, which is 475 miles away from our home, even though there are 3 federal prisons that are closer. So clearly, there was great bias involved, and that's really what raised the eyebrows of Time Magazine, New York Times, you know, 60 Minutes. And unfortunately, when the Supreme Court decided not to hear this case, this judge, the same judge who owned the defense company, who sat on the GOP executive committee, who wanted to see my dad in prison, who had him dragged away in handcuffs and shackles, then decided to put my father in prison on September 11th, a day when there would be absolutely no chance of national media exposure because it was already a day that there would be plenty to talk about. So clearly this entire,
It seems that every time you think it can't get any worse, it gets worse on some level.
And absolutely. Here I am telling you, and yet I'm still learning about things that make my blood boil and make me just, I'm in a perpetual state of shock because I'd like to think that our government is a lot wiser and smarter and certainly we can get over the fact that politics is just politics. But we need to start remembering that there's a reason why we have the debate, and it's to grow and to change and to make things better. And unfortunately, we're taking steps back instead of forward. And so,
what has the Justice Department done about this, Mr. Holder and his army of assistant district attorneys? Anything? Is there anything he can do? Once the federal judge has ruled, that's it?
No, so the President Obama has sort of let the Department of Justice go rogue, and I think he's starting to realize now that he can't do that. I mean, he didn't want to make it part of his platform because it took away from other things that he was trying to accomplish in Congress. So a lot of these judicial appointments he would have to vet through the Senate, and he didn't want to take the time to do that. So he's only replaced about 30% of Bush appointees. And so what we have is a very confusing Department of Justice with 70% still, I don't know if they pledge allegiance to President Bush, but I'm assuming that the Republicans that vetted them for those positions are still their friends, and they probably see the day coming when they're, on the chopping block. So I don't know whose loyalties.
It does seem, if you just take one issue that we've covered here on the program quite a bit, which is the whole question of the failure to prosecute white-collar crime on Wall Street, the failure to go after people who have, in a sense, crippled our economy, and reaching settlements over and over again with companies that have used not only illegal techniques, but certainly deceptive explanations for what they're doing. And there's been nobody, none of the major bankers have gone to jail. There've been a few, lower level people who have been accused and sentenced, but very few. And so by that standard, the Justice Department is not very high in my, kind of level of respect. And to hear that they really stood by while all this was going on involving your father's, is another sad case here.
Well, there's no question that there is an immense amount of hypocrisy that goes on as far as prosecutions go. I mean, they would much prefer to target activists, who have no money to defend themselves, like Aaron Swartz, the MIT student that just committed suicide because he was under such an amount of pressure from these U.S. prosecutors in Massachusetts. They'd much rather go after someone like that than, a political ally or a CEO who has, an incredible amount of resources to defend themselves, which would then what? Make the prosecutor look bad? Why would the prosecutor want to take that chance when they could target someone who, can still make them look good because they're getting rid of, an outspoken advocate of some cause or another?
So tell me about... Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I can finish your sentence. I think everyone who's listening can, because there is such an outrage here. But let's go back to what you're asking people to do and how we can help to the degree that we can at all with this clear case of a miscarriage of justice. Tell us about your petition and what you're hoping to accomplish.
Well, I would love, anyone listening can sign this petition, and that is a huge step. It seems silly, just to put your signature on a petition, but the fact of the matter is the more people that come together in knowledge about this, the better the chance we have of getting change. And so, once you've signed a petition, you know, please share it with your friends and family. The easiest thing to do is just to post it on Facebook and say, hey, heard this girl on the radio today. It's a frustrating story. Sign the petition. But, I mean, you can do more to, you know, get involved. We have a Take Action page. We're planning a march in March, March 3rd in Selma, Alabama, in commemoration of Bloody Sunday, which is a civil rights movement historical event. And a lot of members of Congress, perhaps the president, perhaps the vice president, will be there. But we hope to have an outpouring of support. And we're going to, you know, have our signs and T-shirts and, you know, let our voices be heard. But beyond that, you know, writing to members of Congress and saying, why are you not paying attention to the problems in the court system? Write to Leahy, you know, Senator Leahy. He's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and tell him that, you know, this has been going on for too long. We're sick and tired of the hypocrisy in the Department of Justice. There's got to be a better way to hold these prosecutors accountable. We can't have the pardons attorney's office, you know, being reviewed by the same people who approve the prosecutions from the get-go. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. No,
unless you want to just bury this guy and bury this case. Just one last question. The URL for your website for people who want to find out more.
Yes, it's free-don.org. That's free-don.org. My dad is Don Siegelman. You can also just Google Free Don. It should come right up. And there's a lot more information there if you're interested. You can go to our Take Action page. Thank you for signing the petition.
And Dana, thank you for coming on and allowing me to browbeat you into coming on the program again, because you did a great job of expressing this. I've felt very guilty not having really covered this adequately, and I'm happy to try to contribute in a small way
to giving this
case more visibility. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Danny.
Yeah, and let's just we're going to talk about unions now and the state of unions, not the great state of unions, but a state of unions, with Frank Emspach, who is with Worker Independent News, and he knows a lot about the labor movement and knows about what's wrong with it and knows about how to fix it. So Frank will be joining us, but before he does, we want to go out with a song about labor. Pilar, help me out. What is the song we're going out with?
This song is, I think it's Which Side Are You On?
Which Side Are You On? It's a new version of the old labor classic. Here it is.
Come all you good workers and all you dispossessed. The perps are not in prison. Nobody has confessed. I said, which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? Yeah, which side are you on, girl? Which side are you on? My daddy was a banker, but I'm not a banker's son, 'cause I refuse to profit from the pain of anyone. Yeah, which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? Yeah, which side are you on, girl? Which side are you on?
I'm a union woman, just as brave as I can be. I do not like the bosses, and the bosses don't like me. Join the CIO, come and join the CIO. I was raised in Kentucky born and bred. And when I joined the union, they called me a Russian Red. Join the CIO, come and join the CIO. When my husband asked the boss for a job, this is the words he said. Bill Jackson, I can't work you, sir. Your wife's a Russian Red. Join the CIO, come and join the CIO. If you want to join a union, the strongest one can be. Join the dear old NMU and come along with me.
Well, That's an old classic, really, from the 30s, joined the CIO. The CIO, of course, later merged with the AFL-AVL to AFL-CIO. The values of the CIO were values that were far more, shall we say, populist and mass-based than the values of the AFL-AVL. But the whole question of the future of labor and the reality of labor today is something that we want to spend a little time talking about. And I'm very pleased to have an old friend on with me today who I ran into the other day, and we talked about some of these issues, Frank Imspach. Frank, welcome to the program, and please tell our audience a little bit about your connection to the labor movement.
Hi, my name is Frank Imspach. Well, the connection, actually, as we were discussing, goes back to my grandfather and grandparents. My grandfather was an industrial blacksmith, actually, on the Austrian state railroads in Austria around 1900, and had a strike, and he left town, left Austria, wound up in Schenectady at the General Electric plant there. And my father, my uncles, followed him in the plant. They collectively organized the United Electrical Workers. My father left and went to school and then came back and did that. Turned into one of the key locals in the United Electrical Workers at the time. And I had the opportunity later, when I was in my 30s, to also join the union movement as a, at that time, a skilled machinist, and was elected to office in my plant in Beverly, Massachusetts, the United Shoe Machine Company, which made shoe machines. And then after I was laid off a couple of years later, I was elected as an officer in the successor union to the UE, the IUE, in Lynn, Massachusetts, and served as an officer there for some years.
I should disclose here, Frank, also that I was a professional news dissector at WBCN in Boston when the union, the fires of the union, began burning in my brain, and I was one of the organizers of the United Electrical Workers at WBCN Radio, rock and roll radio in Boston. All of our members joined the UE, and all of us went out on strike to defend the station when it was bought by a outside company, there was a big battle around the station. So I know about these issues, not just as some abstraction, but as something that's really connected to my life. Now, where we are today,
I think the point. I know we have serious questions like what's happening with the trade union movement, you know. But part of it is you got to have heart, and you have to have a sense of who you are. And it doesn't matter what the organizational form is, but if you have heart, if you know who you are, if you know that your job and your friends are the people that are like you, then you have a good start at forming a union. Otherwise, you're lost, I think.
Well, you know, you heard, I hope, some of the music by Paul R. Levine, who's done a updated version of Which Side Are You On? And we just heard a song about the CIO, which...
Well, it's interesting because the end was NMU. Who knows the NMU? That was the National Maritime Union, which was a integrated effort to, or because the prior ship unions in the AFL were segregated, attempt to build the maritime union, which of course is now gone, but pretty much. But it's interesting, the CIO as a social movement, and I think that's what was in the song. Maybe we need it again, huh? You think?
Well, you know, this is the whole question about unions starting in a way as social movements, as movements to try to address injustices against workers, to try to have workers have some power over the terms of their employment, becoming more like a business itself, a business union, which was the original AFL-AVL concept to some degree. And, you know, so there's been a fight not only between management and labor, between Republicans and Democrats over labor, but also battles within the unions over such issues as corruption, for example. There was just an SEIU vice president who was just convicted of a massive theft of union members' money on the West Coast. So there, all of these problems are being fought out, some in the media and some not. What is your take on the state of the union? You know, if you were giving the state, not the State of the Union address, but the State of the Union's address, what would be its key points?
I think the first key point I would make is that unlike the 30 years or so between, say, 1937-38, when the steel companies went to a leader of the steel union then, Philip Murray, and said, listen, we can't tolerate this level of unrest. We'll make a deal. We'll recognize the union. And that was the biggest corporation, one of the biggest in the world at the time, saying, let's end this class war that was going on in the steel mills, and we recognize your right to exist. I think what happened starting around 1995 or so, leading sections of what I would call the ruling class, the major corporations, said, you know, we don't need these people anymore. And so rather than working towards a system where they recognize your right to exist, as they do in other parts of the world, but not here in the capitalist world, I think the major corporations have said, we can get rid of these types of organizations. And so you move from let's make a deal, which can encourage business unionism, and sometimes it functions, you know, it works, to let's annihilate these people.
And how did anti-union sentiment migrate from the heads of corporations down to politicians, down to working people?
Well, let's go to the first one. First, you have to buy the notion that the major corporations have decided they're not interested in unions. And I want to just go back one thing here. I know we don't have a lot of time, but let's take the Taft-Hartley Act in 1948. Most of us weren't even born then. But the shrewdness of that was this, and we have an interview on our Workers' Independent News. We actually interviewed the last surviving author of this. He was 95 at the time, sharp as a tack. And he said, you know, we had a big fight amongst the right-wingers at the time. Destroy the unions outright, this is 1948, or constrain them and strangle them slowly by not allowing them to grow, by having all kinds of repressive legislation, by going after a part of their intellectual and political leadership, the communists, right-to-work laws, the whole business. So he said, we, our firm, the Taft Law Firm, said, look, let's do it the slow way. We'll strangle them. And so let's start from that was the enlightened view in 1948. In other words, instead of annihilation, strangling. Okay, if you take that and you say the major corporations have this, then you say, well, how does it migrate? Well, they pay the money, you know, for the corporate, for the politicians. Once you got to a TV media driven election rather than a ward and precinct get out the vote with a human being election, it favors money, not people. And so,
you know, I think General Electric, the company that you worked for, understood that early on, you know, with the General Electric hour, TV hour.
That's right.
Hosted by Ronald Reagan.
Right. Screen Actors Guild, anti-communist, terrible guy. But they, you know, so once the corporations became clearer, clearly the politicians became clearer. They're paying them one way or the other. I'm not talking about an actual bribe here. There are a lot of ways to do it. You want to keep this plant. You want to keep employment. Help us out, you know, and so on and so forth. In terms of actual workers, I don't see any shift in union or anti-union sentiment.
Really, you don't? There were all those demonstrations, but when it came down to voting to recall Walker, you know, what happened? Where were the workers?
Well, the workers actually, by and large, voted to recall Walker, but there are more. Two things happened. I mean, let's talk about union sentiment, then politics, and whether you're going to join a union, because there are three different things. There were a lot of very, very strong union people at General Electric when I worked there and still. And one of the things people would say to me is that, you know, don't put your head too far above the trench line or somebody's going to blow it off, you know. Now, these were union people, but they weren't kamikaze pilots either. And so when the cost to join a union is your job, which is often the case now, that's a little different than saying, well, yes, I think unions are good. So 65% of the working class has been in a consistent, yes, the unions are good polling situation. Okay. But joining situations, another story for the reason I was alluding to.
Yeah, I mean, you don't...
The costs are high. And the benefits are not as clear. So that's one aspect. Voting is a whole other thing, because two things have to happen. One, you have to be motivated to vote and see that in this case, the opposition to Governor Walker is clearly in your side. And in this case, in Wisconsin, about 65% of working people voted for the Democrat. About 35% did not. In some households, depending on how you measured it, was 70-30, you know. Why did 40% or 35% of the Wisconsin working class vote for Walker?
Yeah, that's what I'd like to
know. Okay, that's a good question, right? Barrett, who was the Democratic nominee, was running on the basis that he was able to tame the unions in Milwaukee. You know, the public sector union. So it was a little hard for some people to sort of say, wow, you know, a champion of the working class. Well, okay, I guess he's better than Walker. So that's not exactly an enthusiastic thing. Mm-hmm. Secondly, there was nothing in the campaign that said one-third or 27% of paper mill jobs have been lost in Wisconsin. These are the best-paying industrial jobs in the state. There was nothing in the program that directly addressed that, which is the northern part of the state.
So it seems to me that the more the battle became wrapped up in partisan politics and perceived that way by the media, the deeper issues kind of lost sway to the question of who would vote for who.
Right.
And of course, you have a right to elect, but sometimes you don't have the right to select who you're going to vote for.
There's that. I mean, you know, Barron had already won a run and lost. He was not a charismatic candidate, but you can't run from the defensive. You have to have an offensive, clear program. The right wing has that. Cut taxes, create jobs. It may not be true.
Definitely, since wages
have been stagnant for 35 years now, the only way that many, many people see to raise their disposable income, that is what they have to go to the store with, is cutting taxes, because they have not been able to raise wages. But you raised a more fundamental issue when we were talking on Tuesday night, which is...
You, Danny,
the News Dissector, raised a more fundamental issue, which is where is the union movement going, and what is it going to take to revive a union movement? And my response in part was, rarely in our country has the impetus for revival come from within, even though there were many figures and people and money that was supporting outside activity, so to speak. The CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, was organized by young people at the time working in the newly technological industries, electrical and so forth, who said the current organization of the American Federation of Labor based on crafts and whatnot does not meet our needs. And they went and figured out what else to do.
Well, you
now,
know, we're having...
Let me finish your point,
because I have a issue that I want to tie to this. Go ahead.
No, I think today, starting in the 1980s, what we saw was the continual destruction of the industrial base of the United States, one way or the other. I mean, the United Shoe Machine, where I worked, was a great example of that, an integrated plant that made the shoe machines for the entire world. Not the shoes, but the shoe machines. How did they survive? They had an unbreakable monopoly until 1975, so they could charge whatever they wanted, like Xerox, until a few years later. And so, how could you miss, right? You had a very good machine, but still, once they lost that dominance in a certain sense legally, they said, great, close it up here, move it to Brazil, which is what they did. Now, what is the response? The response was trade adjustment assistance, extended unemployment, this, that, and the other thing, things where the state paid the social costs for the move. The company lost nothing. Now, that was a humane response, but an inadequate response. What should the unions now do faced with this? The most important thing is the job. If you're not working, you know, you don't have a job, you can't raise your family, so on and so forth. So I would say, when we talk about the future of the union movement, the future of the workers' movement has to be to say that we are creating wealth, we're not going to allow it to be moved, we're not going to allow it to be dissipated, we want it to be shared. And that's the kind of thing you fight over, and then people say, yeah, I'm ready to lose my job over that, I'm in trouble, we don't do this, I'm ready to move. That's a little different.
But you already have a situation today where so many jobs have been exported overseas, so many factories have been shut down. I mean, I think the figures
on... The United States is the largest, second largest manufacturing power in the world today. Today. Now, the organization is different, and what's being made is different. But in terms of productivity, in terms of value added, all these other ways of measuring, we're right up there. The Chinese may be making a little bit more now in some regards, but, I mean, they're about five times bigger. They should be making more. But on almost all other measurements, we are a manufacturing powerhouse, believe it or not.
So where is the leadership that sees this clearly? I mean, we've just had a report of several hundred thousand union jobs have been lost. Where are the people
union
who,
members
or union members have been lost? You know, presumably their jobs have gone with them to some degree. To what degree is the leadership of the labor movement kind of looking for some new initiatives here to try to deal with these problems?
Well, I do a news service
or
every
old
day.
Old initiatives.
I do a news service every day that focuses on some of these things. And the answer is, it's not clear. But what we do see is what we saw, I think, in the mid-30s in a certain way, almost 100 years ago. Local leaders, and some in unions and some coming into them, taking initiative and causing people further up the line to respond to it. Two of the examples most recently, but there are others I know going on in New York City and elsewhere. One was the Chicago teacher strike, where the teacher said, you know, our job isn't just to go to work every day, it's to defend the school system, it's to educate the children. And looked around and said, you know, if we don't talk to the parents and get this straight with them, we're all done. And they did. And they went on strike. And the governor, Emanuel Rahm there in Chicago, Obama's right-hand man, had a decision to make. Are we going to say it's all illegal? Are we going to say, wait a minute? And to your point the other night, when Mike Quill was in this situation, the Transport Workers Union, he said, all right, you know, arrest all of us, right? Well, couldn't do it. And neither could they in Chicago. The leadership of the Chicago Teachers Union took what I would call a class position, that most people in Chicago are workers. Most kids in school are the children of working class people. Our job as teachers is to provide the best education as possible. And the deal here isn't to move them out, shut schools, destroy our working conditions. We are in this together, parents, teachers. Let's go. And they won.
Well, we did see here in New York, you know, in the Occupy, when Occupy movement began and was threatened initially, labor stood with the Occupy people,
right,
and marched with them. And that was an example of unions who very rarely get involved with social movements, and social movements that very rarely get involved with unions actually connecting with each other. They may have had different organizing principles of how to work and whatnot, but they seem to find common cause.
They did, but you raised the issue of how do these things happen. A similar thing is happening in Seattle today, because you talked about earlier the debate within the labor movement between those who are saying, let's see if we can work something out, and those who are saying, no, wait a minute, you know, we've tried this, it's not going to work. And in education, you know, the leadership of both teachers' unions said, well, look, let's see if we can find ways to accommodate some of these things. Some of these are good ideas. We don't want to be characterized as just, you know, seniority-driven, grievance-driven organizations. We are educators. And, you know, they seriously looked at how you can do vouchers. For instance, in Madison, Wisconsin, the charter schools are in the school system. They're in the union. They're in the contract. And so the money doesn't go out of the school system, at least within the Madison Metropolitan School District, for those schools here. Next door, you can still take a voucher and, and impoverished.
Well,
schools.
You know,
wait. So
Well, wait, you wait for a second. You're raising a point about education. I've just finished a film about my own high school here in New York City, which is being threatened with closure. And you have a situation here where it seems like charter schools are being used as an alternative, a possible alternative to public education as
Correct.
We've known it. And there are some dangers in that. There may be some positive things in the sense where you have a motivated group of people trying to be more innovative in educational techniques and all the rest of it. But there's still, you know, a battle taking place inside the city school system.
Well, inside every major, it's an attempt to privatize just not the schools, but the decision making. But you raise the question of where are we going? So in Seattle, the teacher said these tests don't help the kids. They're used to evaluate us, and it's pointless. We waste time on this. We're not going to do it. And these teachers banded together. They're in the union and said, you know, we're done with this. And they've stopped. They refused to give the test. They refused to hand it out. They said, we're going to teach something that teaches kids how to be creative, not how to pass the test. School board's position in Seattle is we're going to suspend all you people. The union's position is, no, you're not. And finally, it didn't take too long, both the NEA, the National Education Association, we interviewed them this morning, and the AF, the American Federation of Teachers, said, we're going to defend these people. We've had it.
So this is some breaking news for you.
Thing,
absolutely.
Huh?
And I'd like to just have you tell us, how can people get in touch with your Workers Independent News? Is there a website? Is there a place to go? Can you tell us about it? Because I think what you're doing is really important, and I'd like to spread the word if I could.
Well, the easiest way is to go to Google and go to WIN, and usually WIN comes up first. Sometimes not, so you go to Labor Radio, and that always comes up first.
So it's Workers Independent News,
right?
And it's Labor Radio, and that's Frank Emspach with us. Frank, thanks so much for coming on. We could talk a lot more, but we're running out of time here.
Oh, right, yeah, sorry about that.
Unfortunately, but listen, I really appreciate your coming on, and I'm going to talk to the station here about whether they'd be open to a labor show, and let's see what they say.
That's what we need.
We could do this on a regular basis, vice versa, because we have a hour-long show out here.
Okay,
and
well,
I think we can talk about that.
Absolutely. Frank Emspach, thank you for coming on. I want to make a few announcements, if I may, as we come down to the end of the program. First, a lot of what goes on in this program is a continuity with the blog I write every day at newsdissector.net. This week, or early next week, mediachannel.org, our site that we created in the year 2000, which was supported by the late Walter Cronkite, as a website about media change and what's happening in the media, is coming back online, mediachannel.org. Watch for it. Polarity One's website is
polarityone.com.
And you'll find a lot of great music that you can download for free and share with your friends, because it's music that matters. It's music about what's going on in the world. Your comments are welcome to dissector@mediachannel.org. You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network, PRN FM. The actual podcast of this program will be posted in the archives tomorrow and will be on my blog hopefully tomorrow as well, so we can pass the word on about this radio show. From me, Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, and
from Polarity One, have a nice morning, evening, afternoon.
I couldn't say it better myself.
To chase and to walk.